read my mother's journals, but I can't. It makes it hard to breathe. So I take out my stash of money, which is literally down to 6 individual dollar bills, and fold each of them into a tiny elephant. I have a herd marching across my desk. Then I turn on my computer. I log on to the Name Us website and click on the new cases. There's an 18-year-old boy who disappeared after dropping his mom off at work in Westminster, North Carolina. He drove a green Dodge Dart with the license plate 58U7334. He had shoulder-length blonde hair and fingernails filed into points. A 72-year-old female from West Hartford, Connecticut, who takes medicine for paranoid schizophrenia and who walked away from a group home after telling the staff she was going to audition for Cirque du Soleil. She had been wearing blue jeans and a sweatshirt with a picture of a cat on it. A 22-year-old girl from Ellendale, North Dakota, who left her house with an older, unidentified male and never came back home. I could click on these links all day long, and by the time I was done, there would be hundreds more. There are an endless number of people who have left a love-shaped hole in the heart of someone else. Eventually, someone brave and stupid will come along and try to fill that hole, but it never works. And so instead, that selfless soul winds up with a gap in his heart, too. And so on. It's a miracle that anyone survives when so much of us is missing. For just a moment, I let myself imagine what my life might have been like. My mother and my baby sister and I, cuddled under a blanket on the couch on a rainy Sunday, her arms around us, one on each side as we watched a chick flick. My mother yelling at me to pick up my sweatshirt because the living room is not my hamper. My mother doing my hair for my junior prom while my sister pretends to put on mascara in the bathroom mirror. My mother taking too many pictures as I pin the boutonniere on my date, and me pretending to be annoyed, but in reality, being psyched that for her this moment is nearly as monumental as it is for me. My mother rubbing my back when that same boy breaks up with me a month later, telling me he was an idiot, because who couldn't love a girl like me? The door to my room opens and my grandmother walks in. She sits on the bed.
I thought at first you didn't realize how worried I could possibly have been when you didn't come home that first night, or even try to get in touch with me.
I look down at my lap, my face hot.
But then I realized I was wrong. You could understand it perfectly. Better than anyone else, because you know what it's like to have someone disappear.
I went to Tennessee, I confess.
You went where?
She says.
How?
Bus, I tell her. I went to the sanctuary where all our elephants were sent. My grandmother's hand flutters at her throat.
You traveled 1,000 miles to go to a zoo?
It's not a zoo. It's like the anti-zoo, I correct. And yeah, I went because I was trying to find someone who knew my mother. I thought Gideon might be able to tell me what happened to her.
Gideon,
she repeats. They work together, I say. I do not say they were having an affair.
And?
My grandmother asks. I nod, slowly pulling the scarf from around my neck. It's so light that I imagine it would not even register on a scale. A cloud, a breath, a memory. Grandma, I whisper. I think she's dead. Until now, I hadn't realized that words have sharp edges, that they can cut your tongue. I don't think I could utter another sentence right now if I tried. My grandmother reaches for the scarf, wrapping it around her hand like a bandage.
Yes,
she says.
I think so, too.
Then she rips the scarf in half. I cry out, I'm that shocked.
What are you doing?
My grandmother scoops up the stack of my mother's journals that are piled on my desk, too.
It's for your own good, Jenna.
Tears spring to my eyes. Those are not yours! It hurts, seeing her with all that I have left of my mom. She's ripping away my skin. And now I'm raw and exposed.
They're not yours either,
my grandmother says.
This is not your research. and it's not your history. Tennessee, this has gone too far. You need to start living your own life instead of hers. I hate you! I scream. But my grandmother is already on her way out the door. She pauses at the threshold. You keep looking for your family, Jenna, but it's always been right under your nose. When she leaves, I pick up the stapler on my desk and throw it at the door. Then I sit down, wiping my nose with the back of my hand. I start plotting how I will find that scarf and sew it together, how I will steal back those journals. But the truth is, I don't have my mother. I never will. I don't get to rewrite my story. I just have to stumble to the end of it. The case of my mother's disappearance glows on the laptop screen in front of me, full of details that don't matter anymore. I click on the settings of the Name Us profile, and with a single keystroke, delete it. One of the first things my grandmother taught me when I was little was how to get out of the house during a fire. Each of our bedrooms had a special emergency ladder stacked underneath the window, just in case. If I smelled smoke, if I felt the door and found heat, I was supposed to throw open the sash, hook the ladder into place, and rappel my way down the side of the house to safety. Never mind that as a 3-year-old, I couldn't lift that ladder, much less pry open the window. I knew what the protocol was, and that was supposed to be enough to ward off the possibility of any harm coming to me. The superstition worked, I guess, because we've never had a fire in this house. But that dusty old ladder is still underneath my bedroom window, having served as a shelf for my books, a rack for my shoes, a table for my knapsack, but never as a means of escape. Until now. This time, though, I leave a note for my grandmother. I will stop. I promise. But you have to give me one last chance to say goodbye. I promise I'll be back in time for dinner tomorrow. I open the window and hook the ladder into place. It doesn't seem sturdy enough to hold my weight, and I think about how ridiculous it would be if you were trying to survive a house fire but wound up killing yourself instead in a fall. The ladder gets me only to the sloped roof over the garage, which really isn't a help at all. But by now, I'm quite the escape artist, so I inch myself over the edge and hook my fingers into the rain gutter. From there, it's only a drop of about 5 feet to the ground. My bike is where I left it, balanced against the front porch railing. I hop on and start pedaling. Riding is different in the middle of the night. I move like the wind. I feel invisible. The streets are damp because it's been raining, and the pavement shines everywhere but the trail left by my bike tires. The zooming taillights of cars remind me of sparklers I used to play with on the 4th of July. How the glow hung in the darkness. How you could wave your arms and paint an alphabet of light. I navigate by feel because I can't read the signs. And before I know it, I'm in downtown Boone at the bar beneath Serenity's apartment. It's hopping. Instead of a token few drunks, there are girls squeezed into spandex dresses, hanging on the biceps of bikers. There are skinny dudes leaning against the brick wall to have a smoke between shots. The noise from the jukebox spills into the street, and I hear someone urging, "Chug, chug, chug."
"Hey, baby,"
a guy slurs.
"Can I buy you a drink?"
"I'm 13, I say.
"I'm Raul."
I duck my head and push past him, dragging my bike into the entryway to Serenity's house. I lug it up the stairs and into her foyer again, careful not to upset the table this time. But before I can knock on the door softly, I mean, it's 2 a.m. It opens.
"You couldn't sleep either, sugar?"
Serenity says. "How did you know I was here?"
"You don't exactly float up the stairs like a fairy when you're dragging that damn thing around."
She falls back so that I can step into her apartment. It looks the way I remember it from the first time I came here, when I still believed that finding my mother was what I wanted most in the world.
"I'm surprised your grandmother let you come here this late," Serenity says.
I didn't give her a choice.
I sink down on the couch and she sits beside me. This so sucks, I say. She doesn't pretend to misunderstand me.
Well, don't jump to conclusions just yet. Virgil says,
fuck Virgil, I interrupt. Whatever Virgil says won't bring her back to life. Do the math. If you tell your husband you're pregnant with another guy's kid, he isn't going to throw you a baby shower. I've tried, believe me, but I can't summon up hate for my father. Only pity, really. A dull ache. If my dad was the one who killed my mom, I don't think he'll wind up going to trial. He's institutionalized already. No prison is going to be more punishing than the confines of his own mind. It just means exactly what my grandmother said. She's the only family I really have left. I know it's my fault. I know I'm the one who asked Serenity to help me find my mother, who got Virgil on board. This is what curiosity gets you. You might live on top of the biggest toxic waste dump on the planet, but if you never dig, then all you ever know is that your grass is green and your garden is lush.
People don't realize how hard it is, she says.
When my clients used to come to me asking to talk to Uncle Saul or their beloved grandma, all they were focusing on was the hello, the chance to say what they didn't say when the person was alive. But when you open a door, you have to close it behind you. You might say hello,
but you also wind up saying goodbye.
I face her. I wasn't asleep when you and Virgil were talking in the car. I heard everything you said. Serenity freezes.
Well then, she says, I guess you know I'm a fraud.
You aren't, though. You found that necklace and the wallet. She shakes her head.
I just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
I think about this for a moment. But isn't that what being psychic is? I can tell that she never thought about it that way. One man's coincidence is another's connection. Does it matter if it's gut feeling, like Virgil says, or psychic intuition, if you still get what you're searching for? She pulls a blanket up from the floor to cover her feet and casts it wide so it will cover me too.
Maybe, she concedes. Still, it's nothing like what it used to be. Other people's thoughts, they just were suddenly there in my head. Sometimes the connection was crystal clear, and sometimes it was like being on a cell phone in the mountains where you only catch every third word. But it was more than stumbling over something shiny in the grass.
We are cuddled under a blanket that smells like Tide and Indian food, and rain is striking the windows from outside. I realize this is very close to the image I'd conjured earlier of what my life would have been like if my mother had survived. I glance at Serenity. Do you miss it? Hearing from people who are gone?
Yes,
she admits. I lean my head on her shoulder.
Me too, I say.
Alice. Gideon's arms were the safest place in the world. When I was with him, I forgot how Thomas's highs and his lows scared the hell out of me, how every morning started with an argument and every night ended with my husband locked in his office with his secrets and the shadows of his mind. When I was with Gideon, I could pretend that the three of us were the family I had hoped to be. Then I found out we would be four.
It's going to be okay,
he'd promised when I told him the news, although I did not believe him. He couldn't tell the future. He could just, I hoped, be mine. Don't you see? Gideon had said, lit from within.
We were meant to be together.
Maybe we were. But what a price to pay. His marriage, mine, Grace's life. Still, we dreamed out loud in Technicolor. I wanted to take Gideon back to Africa with me so he could see these incredible animals before they had been broken by humans. Gideon wanted to move south where he'd come from. I resurrected my dream of running away with Jenna, but this time I imagined that he would come with us. We pretended to be racing forward, but we didn't move an inch because of the trap doors that threatened to swallow us. He had to tell his mother-in-law. I had to tell my husband. But we had a deadline, because it was getting very hard to hide the changes to my body. One day, Gideon found me working at the Asian barn.
"I told Nevi about the baby," he said.
I froze. What did she say?
She told me I should have everything I deserve. Then she walked away from me.
Just like that, this wasn't a fantasy anymore. It was real, and it meant that if he had been brave enough to confront Nevi, I had to be brave enough to confront Thomas. I did not see Nevi all day, or Gideon either, for that matter. I tracked Thomas's whereabouts and followed him around from enclosure to enclosure. I cooked him dinner. I asked him to help me do a foot soak on Lily when normally I would have asked Gideon or Nevi for assistance. Instead of avoiding him, as I'd been doing for months, I talked to him about the applications he'd received for a new caregiver and asked him if he'd made a decision yet to hire anyone. I lay down with Jenna until she fell asleep and then went to his office and started to read an abstract as if it was normal for us to share the space. I thought he might tell me to get lost, but Thomas smiled at me, an olive branch.
"I forgot how nice it used to be,"
he said.
"You and me working side by side."
Resolve is like porcelain, isn't it? You can have the best intentions, but the moment there's a hairline crack, it is only a matter of time before you go to pieces. Thomas poured himself a tumbler of scotch and another one for me. I left mine sitting on the desk. "I'm in love with Gideon," I said bluntly. His hands went still on the decanter. Then he picked up his glass and finished the shot.
"You think I'm blind?"
"We're leaving," I told him. "I'm pregnant." Thomas sat down. He buried his face in his hands and started to weep. I stared for a moment, torn between comforting him and hating myself for being the one to reduce him to this. A broken man with a failing sanctuary, a cheating wife, and a mental illness. "Thomas," I begged, "say something." His voice hitched.
"What did I do wrong?"
I knelt in front of him. I saw in that instant the man whose glasses had fogged in the steamy heat of Botswana. The man who had met me at the airport, clutching the roots of a plant. The man who had a dream and had invited me to take part in it. I had not seen that man for a very long time. But was it because he'd disappeared? Or because I'd stopped looking? "You did nothing," I replied. "It was me." He reached out, grasping my shoulder with one hand. With the other, he smacked me so hard across the face that I tasted blood.
"Whore,"
he said. Clutching my cheek, I fell backward. I backed away from him as he advanced toward me, scrambling to get out of the room. Jenna was still asleep on the couch. I raced toward her, determined to take her with me as I walked out the door this last time. I could buy clothes and toys and anything else she needed later, but Thomas grabbed my wrist, wrenching it behind me, so that I fell again, and he reached our child first. He picked up her small body, and she curled into him.
"Daddy?" she sighed,
still caught in the web between dreams and truth. He wrapped his arms around her, turning her so that Jenna was no longer facing me.
You want to go?
Thomas said.
Be my guest. But you want to take my daughter with you? Over my dead body.
He smiled at me then. A terrible, terrible smile.
Or better yet, he said, over yours.
She would wake up, and I would be gone. Her worst fear come true. I'm sorry, baby, I said silently to Jenna. Then I ran for help, leaving her behind.
Virgil. Even if I'd been able to find the body that was buried 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to get a court order. I don't know what I was thinking I'd resort to, shy of sneaking into a graveyard, Frankenstein style, to dig up a corpse that I had assumed was Nevi Rule. But before a body is released to a funeral home, the medical examiner does the autopsy. And the autopsy would have had a DNA sample taken by the state lab, stored somewhere in FTA card files for posterity. No way in hell am I going to be able to get the state lab to cough up evidence to me now that I'm a civilian. Which means I have to find someone they would give it to. So a half hour later, I'm leaning on the ledge of the evidence room at the Boone PD, sweet-talking Ralph again. You're back? He sighs. What can I say? I missed you desperately. You haunt my dreams. I already took a chance letting you in last time, Virgil. I'm not risking my job for you. Ralph, you and I both know that the chief wouldn't give this job to anyone else. You're like the Hobbit guarding the ring, man. What? You're the D. Brown of the department. Without him, nobody would have even known the Celtics existed in the 90s, right? Ralph's wrinkles deepen as he grins. Well, now you're talking, he says. It's true. These young guys don't know their ass from their elbow. I come down here every morning and someone's moved crap around, trying to classify it some newfangled computerized way, and you know what happens? Shit gets lost. So I move it back where it belongs. You know what I say. If it ain't broke. I nod, like I'm hanging on his every word. This is what I'm talking about. You're the central nervous system of this outfit, Ralph. Without you, everything would fall apart. That's why I knew you were the right guy to turn to for help. He shrugs, trying to look humble. I wonder if he realizes I'm good copping him, buttering him up so that I can get something out of him in return. Up in the break room, officers are probably still talking about how he's senile and so slow-moving that he could drop dead in the evidence room and no one would notice for a week. You remember how I was reviewing an old case, right? I say, leaning closer so that he's in on the secret. I'm trying to get a DNA sample from the blood that was taken by the state lab. Any chance you could place a few calls? Make that happen? I would if I could, Virgil, but the state lab's pipes burst 5 years ago. They lost 8 whole years' worth of evidence when the FTA cards were destroyed. It's like 1999 through 2007 never happened. The smile on my face stiffens. Thanks anyway, I tell him, and I slip out of the PD before anyone can see me. I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to break this news to Jenna when I pull up to my office building and see Serenity's VW Bug parked out front. As soon as I get out of my truck, Jenna is in my face, peppering me with questions. What did you find out? Is there a way to figure out who was buried? What about the fact that it's been 10 years? Is that going to be a problem? I glance at her. Did you bring me coffee? What? She says. No. Then get me some and come back. It's too early for the third degree. I climb the stairs to my office, aware that Jenna and Serenity are trailing behind. I unlock the door, stepping over the hills of evidence to get to my desk chair, where I collapse. It's going to be more challenging than I thought to find a DNA sample from whoever we identified as Nevi Rule 10 years ago. Serenity looks around the office, which is marginally more disarrayed than a bomb site. It's a wonder you can find anything at all in here, sugar. I wasn't looking here, I argue, wondering why I'm even bothering to explain the flowchart of police evidence preservation to someone who probably believes in magic. And then my eye falls on the small envelope tossed on top of the other detritus on my desk. Inside is the fingernail I'd found in the seam of the victim's uniform shirt. The same uniform shirt that had freaked Jenna out, because it was stiff with blood. Tallulah takes one look at Serenity and throws her arms around me.
Victor, this is so sweet of you.
We never get to hear how the stuff we do in the lab plays out in the real world. She beams at Jenna.
You must be so happy to have your mom back.
Oh, I'm not,
Serenity says, at the same time Jenna goes,
not quite.
Actually, I explain, we haven't found Jenna's mother yet. Serenity's helping me out with the case. She's a psychic. Tallulah makes a beeline for Serenity.
I had this aunt. She told me her whole life she was going to leave me her diamond earrings, but she dropped dead without a will, and wouldn't you know it, those earrings never turned up. I'd love to know which one of my sleazy cousins stole them.
I'll let you know if I hear anything, Serenity murmurs.
I lift up the paper bag I have brought to the lab.
I need another favor, Lulu.
She raises a brow.
By my count, you haven't paid me back for the last one.
I flash my dimples. I promise, as soon as this case is solved.
Is that a bribe to push your test to the front of the line?
Depends, I flirt. Do you like bribes?
You know what I like,
Tallulah breathes. It takes a moment to untangle myself from her and shake the contents of the paper bag onto a sterile table. What I'd like is for you to take a look at this. The shirt is dirty, shredded, nearly black. Tallulah takes a swab from a cabinet, moistens it, and rubs it over the shirt. The cotton tip comes away pinkish-brown. It's 10 years old, I tell her. I don't know how badly it's been compromised, but I'm hoping like hell you can tell me if it looks at all like the mtDNA you took from Jenna. From my pocket, I pull the envelope with the fingernail inside. And this one, too. If my hunch is right, one is going to be a match and one isn't. Jenna stands on the other side of the metal table. The fingers of one hand just graze the edge of the shirt fabric. The fingers of the other hand are pressed into her own carotid artery, feeling the pulse.
I'm going to throw up,
she mutters, and she bolts from the room.
I'll go,
Serenity says.
No,
I tell her.
Let me.
I find Jenna at the brick wall behind the building where we laughed ourselves silly once. Except now she's dry-heaving, her hair and her face and her cheeks flushed. I put my hand on the small of her back. She wipes her mouth on her sleeve.
Did you ever get the flu when you were my age?
I guess, yeah.
Me too. I stayed home from school, but my grandma, she had to go to work, so there was no one to pull my hair out of my face or to hand me a washcloth or get me ginger ale or anything.
She looks at me.
It would have been nice, you know? But instead, I get a mom who's probably dead and a father who killed her.
She collapses against the wall, and I sit down beside her.
Well, I don't know about that, I admit.
Jenna turns to me.
What do you mean?
You were the one who first said that your mom wasn't a murderer, that the hair on the body proved that she had some contact with Nevi at the site where she was trampled.
But you said you saw Nevi in Tennessee.
I did. And I do think that there was a mix-up, and that the body identified as Nevi Rule wasn't Nevi Rule. But that doesn't mean Nevi wasn't involved in some way. That's why I asked Lulu to test the fingernail. Say the blood comes back matching your mom's, and the fingernail doesn't. That tells me someone was fighting with her before she died. Maybe that fight got out of control, I explain.
Why would Nevi want to hurt my mom?
Because, I say, your dad isn't the only one who would have been upset to hear she was having Gideon's baby.
It is a fact universally acknowledged, Serenity says. There is no greater force on earth than a mother's revenge.
The waitress who comes to refill her coffee cup gives her a strange look.
You should embroider that on a pillow, I tell Serenity.
We are at the diner down the street from my office. I didn't think Jenna would want to eat after being sick, but to my surprise, she is ravenous. She's consumed an entire plate of pancakes and half of mine.
How long will it take the lab to get the results? Serenity asks.
I don't know. Lulu knows I want it done yesterday.
I still don't get why Gideon would have lied about the body, Serenity says. He must have known it was Alice when he found her.
That's easy. He's a suspect if the body is Alice's. He's a victim if the body is Nevi's. And when she wakes up in the hospital and remembers what went down, she bolts because she's afraid she's going to be arrested for murder. Serenity shakes her head.
You know, if you get tired of being an investigator, you'd make a fantastic swamp witch. You could make a fortune doing cold readings.
By now, other people in the diner are giving us strange looks. I guess it's legitimate to talk about the weather and the Red Sox, but not murder investigations, or the paranormal. The same waitress walks over.
If you're nearly done, we could use the table.
This is bullshit, because the diner is half empty. I start to argue, but Serenity waves her hand.
The hell with them, she says.
She takes a $20 bill out of her pocket, enough to cover the bill with a 3-cent tip, and slaps it on the table before hoisting herself out of the booth and walking outside.
Serenity?
Jenna's been so quiet that I've almost forgotten about her.
What you said about Virgil being a good swamp witch? What about me?
Serenity smiles.
Honey, I've told you before that you probably have more actual psychic talent than you think. You've got an old soul.
Can you teach me?
Serenity looks at me and then back at Jenna.
Teach you what?
How to be psychic.
Sugar, it doesn't work that way.
Well, how does it work?
Jenna presses.
You don't actually know, do you? You haven't had it work, in fact, for a really long time. So maybe trying something different isn't a bad idea.
She faces me.
I know you're all about facts and figures and evidence you can touch, but you're the one who said that sometimes when you look at the same thing a dozen times, it takes try number 13 before what you're looking for jumps out at you. The wallet and the necklace and even the shirt with the blood on it. All that stuff's been waiting for a decade and no one managed to find it.
Then she turns to Serenity.
You know, I said last night that you were in the right place at the right time whenever we found those things. Well, I was there too. What if those signs weren't meant for you, but for me? What if the reason you can't hear my mom is because I'm the one she wants to talk to? Jenna,
Serenity says softly,
it would be the blind leading the blind. What have you got to lose?
She barks a frustrated little laugh.
Oh, let's see. My self-respect? My peace of mind?
My trust?
Jenna says. Serenity meets my gaze over the kid's head.
Help me, she seems to be saying.
I understand why Jenna needs this. Otherwise, it's not a complete circle, it's a line. And lines unravel and send you off in directions you never intended to go. Endings are critical. It's why, when you're a cop, and you tell parents their kid was just found in a car crash, they want to know exactly what happened, if there was ice on the road, if the car swerved to avoid the tractor trailer. They need the details of those last few moments because it is all they will have for the rest of their lives. It's why I should have told Lulu I did not want to go out with her ever again. Because until I do, there will still be a sliver of hope in the door that she can wedge herself into. And it's why Alice Metcalf has haunted me for a decade. I'm the guy who will never turn off a DVD, no matter how crappy the movie. I cheat and read the last chapter of a book first, in case I drop dead before I finish it. I don't want to be left hanging, wondering what will happen for eternity. Which is kind of interesting, because it means that I, Virgil Stanhope, the master of practicality and the grand poobah of proof, must believe at least a tiny bit in some of the metaphysical fluff Serenity Jones peddles. I shrug. Maybe, I say to Serenity, she has a point.
Alice.
One reason infants can't remember events when they are very small is that they don't have the language to describe them. Their vocal cords simply aren't equipped until a certain age, which means instead they use their larynxes for emergency situations only. In fact, there is a direct projection that goes from the amygdala of an infant to his voice box, which can make that baby cry very quickly in a situation of extreme distress. It's such a universal sound that studies have been done showing that just about every other human, even college-age boys who have no experience with babies, will try to provide assistance. As the child grows, the larynx matures and is capable of speech. The sound of crying changes as babies turn 2 or 3, and as it does, people not only become less likely to want to help them, but actually respond to the sound with feelings of annoyance. For this reason, children learn to use their words, because that's the only way they can get attention. But what happens to that original projection, the nerve that runs from the amygdala to the larynx? Well, nothing. Even as vocal cords grow up around it like heliotrope, it stays where it was and is very rarely used. Until, that is, someone leaps out from beneath your bed at night at sleepaway camp, or you turn a corner in a dark alley and a raccoon jumps into your path, or any other moment of complete and abject terror. When that happens, the alarm sounds. In fact, the noise you'll make is one you probably could not replicate voluntarily if you tried.
Serenity. Back when I was good at this kind of thing, if I wanted to contact someone in particular who had passed, I'd rely on Desmond and Lucinda, my spirit guides. I imagined them as telephone operators, connecting to a direct office line because it was so much more efficient than having an open house and sorting through the hordes to find the individual I was hoping to speak to. That's called open channeling. You put out your shingle, open for business, and brace yourself. It's a little like a news conference, with everyone shouting out questions at once. It's hell for the medium, incidentally. But I suppose it's no worse than putting out feelers and having no one show up. I asked Jenna to find me a place that she thinks was special to her mother, and so the three of us trek back to the elephant sanctuary grounds, hiking to a spot where a giant oak, with arms like a titan, presides over a patch of purple mushrooms. "I come here sometimes to hang out," Jenna said. "My mom used to bring me..." It's almost ethereal, the way the mushrooms create a little magic carpet. "How come these don't grow everywhere?" I ask. Jenna shakes her head. "I don't know. According to my mom's journals, it's where Mora's calf was buried." "Maybe it's nature's way of remembering, I guess." "More like it's the extra nitrates in the soil," Virgil mutters. I shoot him a sharp glance. "No negativity. Spirits can feel that." Virgil looks like he's about to have a root canal.
"Should I just go over there or something?"
He points off into the distance.
"No, we need you. This is about energy," I say. "That's how spirits manifest."
So we all sit down. Jenna nervous, Virgil reluctant, and me, well, desperate. I close my eyes and wing a little prayer to the powers that be. I will never ask for my gift again. If you let me do this one thing for her. Maybe Jenna is right. Maybe her mother has been trying to communicate with her all along. But until now, she was unwilling to accept the fact that Alice was dead. Maybe she's finally ready to listen.
"So," Jenna whispers, "should we hold hands?"
I used to have clients who would ask how they could tell their loved ones that they missed them. "You just did," I would say. It really is that easy. So this is what I tell Jenna to do.
Tell her why you want to talk to her.
Isn't that obvious?
To me, maybe not to her.
Well, Jenna swallows. I don't know if you can miss someone you can barely remember, but that's how I feel. I used to make up stories about why you hadn't been able to come back to me. You were captured by pirates, and you had to sail around the Caribbean looking for gold. But every night you looked at the stars and thought, at least Jenna's seeing them too. Or you had amnesia, and you lived every day trying to find clues about your past, like all these tiny arrows that would point you back to me. Or you were on a secret mission for the country, and you couldn't reveal who you were without blowing your cover. And when you finally came home, and flags were waving, and crowds were cheering, I'd get to see you as a hero. My English teachers said I had the most amazing imagination, but they didn't understand. It wasn't make-believe to me. It was so real that sometimes it hurt, like a stitch in your side when you run too hard, or the ache in your legs when you have growing pains. But I guess it turns out that maybe you couldn't come to me. So I'm trying to get to you.
I look at her. Anything? Jenna takes a deep breath.
No.
What would make Alice Metcalf, wherever she is, stop and listen? Sometimes the universe gives you a gift. You see a girl, terrified that her mother is gone forever, and you finally understand what needs to be done. Jenna, I gasp, can you see her? She jerks her head around.
Where?
I point. Right there.
I don't see anything,
she says, near tears. You have to focus. Even Virgil is leaning forward now, squinting.
I can't.
Then you're not trying hard enough, I snap. She's getting brighter, Jenna. That light, it's swallowing her. She's leaving this world. This is your last chance. What would make a mother pay attention? Her child's cry.
Mom!
Jenna shrieks until her voice is hoarse, until she's bent forward in the field of violet mushrooms.
She's gone?
Jenna sobs, frantic.
She's really gone?
I crawl forward to put my arm around her, wondering how to explain that I never really saw Alice at all, that I lied to get Jenna to pour her heart into that one desperate word. Virgil gets to his feet, scowling. It's all crap anyway, he mutters. What's this? I ask. I reach for the sharp object that has poked into my calf, making me wince. It's buried under the heads of the mushrooms, invisible, until I dig through their roots and find a tooth.
Alice. All this time, I've said that elephants have an uncanny ability to compartmentalize death without letting grief cripple them permanently. But there is an exception. In Zambia, a calf that had been orphaned by poaching began to hang around with a bunch of young bulls. Just as teenage males will walk up to each other and punch each other on the shoulder to say hello while girls hug, the behavior of these male elephants was very different from what a young female elephant might have experienced otherwise. They tolerated her hanging around because they could mate with her, like anybody's in West Side Story, but they didn't really want her there. She calved when she was only 10 years old, and since she had no mother to guide her, and no practice being an allomother in a breeding herd, she treated that baby the way she had been treated by the bulls. When the baby fell asleep beside her, she would get up and walk away. The calf would wake up and start bellowing for its mother, but she would ignore the cries. By contrast, in a breeding herd, if a baby squeals, at least 3 females rush to touch it all over, and see if it is okay. In the wild, a young female is an Alamother long before she bears her own offspring. She has 15 years to practice being a big sister to the calves that are born to the herd. I'd seen calves approach young female elephants to suckle for comfort, even though the juveniles did not have breasts or milk yet. But the young female would put her foot forward, the way her mother and aunties did, and proudly pretend. She could act like a mother without having any of the real responsibility until she was ready. But when there is no family to teach a young female to raise her own calf, things can go horribly awry. When I was working in Polanisburg, this story repeated itself. There, young bulls that had been translocated began to charge vehicles. They killed a tourist. More than 40 white rhino were found dead in the reserve before we realized that these sub-adult males were the ones who'd attacked them. Highly aggressive behavior that was far from normal. What is the common denominator for the odd behavior of the young female elephant that didn't care about her own calf and the belligerent pack of teenage bulls? Certainly, there was a lack of parental guidance. But was that the only issue at play? All those elephants had seen their families killed in front of them as a result of culling. The grief that I have studied in the wild, where a herd loses an old matriarch, for example, must be contrasted to the grief that comes from observing the violent death of a family member, because the long-term effects are so markedly different. After a natural death, the herd encourages the grieving individual to eventually move on. After a mass killing by humans, there is, by definition, no herd left for support. To date, the animal research community has been reluctant to believe that elephant behavior might be affected by the trauma of watching one's family being killed. I think this isn't scientific objection as much as it is political shame. After all, we humans have been the perpetrators of this violence. At the very least, it is crucial when studying the grief of elephants to remember that death is a natural occurrence. Murder is not.
Jenna. It's from Mora's calf, I tell Virgil as we wait in the same room where we met Tallulah 2 hours ago. That's what I keep telling myself, because it's really too hard to think about the alternative. Virgil turns the tooth over in his hand. It makes me think of the descriptions of elephants rubbing their feet over tiny bits of ivory in my mother's journals, the ones my grandmother took from me.
It's too small to be from an elephant, he says.
There are other animals around, too, you know. Fisher cats, raccoons, deer.
I still think we should take it to the police, Serenity says.
I can't look her in the eye. She's explained her little trick, that my mother had never appeared, as far as she knew, anyway. But for some reason, this only makes me feel worse.
We will,
Virgil agrees.
Eventually.
The door opens and an air-conditioned breeze slices between us. Tallulah enters, looking pissed.
This is getting ridiculous. I don't work for you exclusively, Vic. I'm doing you a favor.
He holds out the tooth.
I swear to God, Lou, if you do this, I will never ask for anything again. We may have found the remains of Alice Metcalf. Forget the blood and the shirt. If you can find DNA in this.
I don't need to, Tallulah says. This tooth doesn't belong to Alice Metcalf. I told you it came from an animal, I mutter.
No, it's human. I worked in a dental office for 6 years, remember? It's a second molar. I could tell you that in my sleep. But it's a deciduous tooth.
What's that?
Virgil asks. Tallulah hands it back to him. It belonged to a kid. Probably one under the age of 5.
The pain that erupts in my mouth is like nothing I've ever felt. It's a cavern with lava inside. It's stars exploding where my eyes were. It's a raw, shimmering nerve. It's what happened. When I wake up, my mother is gone, just like I knew would happen all along. It is why I don't like to close my eyes, because when you do, people disappear. And if people disappear, you don't know for sure that they are ever coming back. I can't see my mother. I can't see my father. I start to cry. And then someone else, someone different, picks me up. "Don't cry," she whispers. "Look, I have ice cream." She shows me. It is the chocolate kind on a stick that I cannot eat fast enough, so it melts all over my hands and turns them the same color as Gideon's. I like when that happens, because then we match. She puts on my jacket and my shoes. She tells me we are going on an adventure. Outside, the world seems too big, like the way it feels when I close my eyes to go to sleep and worry that no one will ever find me again in all the darkness. That's when I start to cry, and my mother always comes. She lies down with me on the couch until I stop thinking about how the night has swallowed us, and by the time I remember to start thinking about it again, the sun is back. But tonight my mother doesn't come. I know where we are going. It's the place where I run in the grass sometimes, and where we go to watch the elephants. But I'm not supposed to be in here anymore. My father shouts about it. A cry swells in my throat, and I think it's going to come out, but she bounces me on her hip and says, "Now, Jana, you and I were just going to play a game. You love games, don't you?" And I do. I love games. I can see the elephant in the trees playing hide-and-seek. I think maybe that is the game we are going to play. It's funny to think of Mora being it. I giggle, wondering if she will tag us with her trunk.
"That's better," she says. "That's my good girl. That's my happy girl."
But I am not her good girl or her happy girl. I belong to my mother.
"Lie down," she tells me. "Lie on your back and look up at the stars. Let's see if you can find the elephant in the spaces between them."
I like games, so I try. But all I see is the night, like a bowl knocked upside down and the moon falling out. What if the bowl drops and traps me? What if I'm hidden and my mother can't find me? I start to cry.
She says.
Her hand comes over my mouth and pushes down. I try to get away because I do not like this game. In her other hand, she holds a big rock. For a while, I am asleep, I think. I dream my mother's voice. All I can see are the trees leaning together like they are trying to tell secrets as Mora bursts through them. And then I am somewhere else, outside, above, around, watching a picture of myself like when my mother puts on movies of me as a baby and I see myself on TV, even though I am still here. I am being carried, and there's a bounce to it, and we go a long way. When Mora puts me down, she rubs me with her back foot, and I think she would have been so good at hide-and-seek after all. Because she is so gentle. When she pats me with her trunk, it is the way my mother taught me to touch the baby bird that fell out of its nest this spring. Like I am pretending to be the wind. Everything is soft. The secret of her breath on my cheek. The paintbrush branches she covers me with. Like a blanket to keep me warm. 1 minute, Serenity is standing in front of me. And the next, she's gone.
"Jana!"
I hear her say. And then she's black and white, dappled like static. I'm not in the lab. I'm not anywhere.
anywhere.
Sometimes the connection was crystal clear. And sometimes it was like being on a cell phone in the mountains where you only catch every third word, Serenity had said. I try to listen, but I'm only getting bits and pieces. And then the line goes dead.
Alice. They never found her body. I had seen it with my own eyes, and yet by the time the police got there, Jenna was gone. I read it in the newspapers. I couldn't tell them that I had seen her, lying there on the ground in the enclosure. I couldn't contact the police at all, of course, because then they would come for me. So I scrutinized Boone from 8,000 miles away. I stopped journaling because every day was another day I didn't have my child. I worried that by the time I reached the end of the book, the canyon between who I used to be and who I was now would be so broad that I wouldn't be able to see the far side. I saw a therapist for a while, lying about the circumstances of my sadness, a car accident, and using a fake name, Hannah, a palindrome, a word that means the same thing even if you turn it inside out. I asked him if it was normal, after the disappearance of a child, to still hear her crying in the night and to wake up to that imaginary sound. I asked him if it was normal to wake up and for a few glorious seconds to believe she was on the other side of the wall, still sleeping. He said, "It is normal for you." And that's when I stopped seeing him. What he should have said is, "Nothing will ever be normal again." In 1999, on the day I first learned of the cancer bleaching the life out of my mother, I'd driven blindly through the bush, trying to outrun the news. To my shock, I'd found 5 elephant carcasses with their trunks cut away, and 1 very devastated, very frightened calf. Her trunk was limp, her ears translucent. She could not have been more than 3 weeks old, but I had not known how to care for her, and her story did not end happily. Neither did my mother's. I took a 6-month leave of absence from my postdoctoral research to be with her until she passed away. When I returned to Botswana, I was all alone in the world and threw myself into my work to avoid my grief, only to realize that these great, gracious elephants treated death so matter-of-factly. They did not find themselves thinking in circles, wondering why I had not called home on Mother's Day, questioning why I had always argued with my mother instead of telling her how much I modeled myself on her self-sufficiency, proclaiming I was too busy with my work or too broke to fly home for Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, my birthday. Those spiraling thoughts were killing me, each turn of the screw sinking me into a quicksand of guilt. Almost by accident, I began to study the grief of elephants. I told myself all sorts of excuses about why this was of visceral academic importance. But really, all I wanted to do was learn from the animals, which made it look so easy. When I came back to Africa to heal from the second loss of my life, it was during a time when poaching was on the rise. The killers had gotten smarter. Where they used to shoot the oldest matriarchs and bulls with the biggest tusks, they now randomly targeted a youngster, knowing that would make the herd bunch together in defense, which of course made it easier for poachers to kill en masse. For a long time, no one wanted to admit that the elephants in South Africa were at risk again, but they were. Elephants in bordering Mozambique were being poached heavily, and the orphaned calves ran terrified back into the Kruger. It was one of those calves that I found while I was hiding in South Africa. Her mother, a victim of poaching,